I mean, absolutely. I think there are people in Washington who want that, who believe we – well, you know, they had hoped – let's face it. They hoped that the economic sanctions against Russia would have weakened, if not destroyed, Russia. It did not. Russia's doing fine. They had prepared for those sanctions. The war is not destroying Russia. So now I think there are people who feel like NATO has to be more directly involved to defeat Russia. And that's the name of the game here. And yes, I do think the sending of these troops is a sign that there is a move in that direction to have a direct confrontation with Russia. And again, this should be horrifying to anyone in the world, certainly to Americans, who need to hold their government accountable for this.
Thank you very much for that. Daniel Kovalik, Professor of International Human Rights, University of Pittsburgh School of Law from Pittsburgh, PA. Edward Lisowski, thank you. President of the World Russia Forum from Washington, D.C. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Takway and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 218 to 219 from the chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizkar.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Innalladhina amanu walladhina hajaru wajahadu fi sabilillah. Innalladhina amanu walladhina hajaru wajahadu fi sabilillahi ulaika yarjuna rahmatallah. أُولَٰئِكَ يَرْجُونَ رَحْمَةَ اللَّهِ وَاللَّهُ غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الْخَمْرِ وَالْمَيْسِرِ قُلْ فِيهِمَا كَبِيرٌ وَمَنَافِعُ لِلنَّاسِ للناس وإثمهما أكبر من نفعهما ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو وكذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely those who believed and those who fled their home and strove hard in the way of Allah, these hope for the mercy of Allah, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. They ask you about intoxicants and games of chance. Say, in both of them there is a great sin and means of profit for men, and their sin is greater than their profit. And they ask you as to what they should spend. Say, what you can spare. Thus does Allah make clear to you the communications that you may ponder.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Russia blames Ukraine for what it calls terrorist drone strike on Moscow, as the Ukrainian military launches similar attacks on Crimea. Iran's president says the recent desecration of the Holy Quran contravenes the West's claims to freedom of expression and is an example of modern ignorance. And a Palestinian rights advocacy group says Israeli forces have arrested nearly 600 Palestinian minors in the first half of 2023. It's good to have you with us. Russia's defense ministry says it has intercepted two Ukrainian drones over the capital, Moscow. The ministry called the attack a terrorist act by Ukraine. Moscow's mayor earlier said two buildings suffered damage in the incident. The mayor said there was no casualties and serious damage. According to Russian media, they are located near the defense ministry's headquarters in central Moscow. In a separate incident, the governor of Russian-held Crimea said a Ukrainian drone strike hit an ammunition depot there. The governor said air defenses downed 11 of the drones. Kiev is yet to comment. It almost never publicly claims responsibility for attacks inside Russia or on Russian-controlled territory in Ukraine. Johnny Miller is our correspondent joining us to tell us more about this. Johnny, what do you have for us?
Well, yes, around 4 a.m. this morning, two drones entered the relative center of Moscow, hitting non-residential blocks. They seem to have done very little damage. There have been numerous attacks with drones over the last 6 months or so. Of course, the attack on the Kremlin, and then in the south of Moscow. None of these drone attacks have achieved very much, merely just breaking a few windows. I think the greater concern for Russia are the attacks in Crimea, one hitting an ammunition dump. Ukraine has had some success in Ukraine recently, a huge amount of drones being launched there, mostly shot down by air defense, but some are getting through, and that'll be Russia's main concern. Are these drone attacks in Moscow timed for any reason, or are they just coincidental? Recently, the recent nights, we've had Russia striking Odessa very hard, military targets there, cathedral also hit. Ukraine blames Russia. Russians saying that it was an Ukrainian anti-air defense missile that hit it. But President Zelensky said that there will be retaliation for those strikes in Odessa. Perhaps these drone strikes in Moscow are connected with that, or they may just be coincidental.
Does that affect the morale of people in Russia as a whole, and Moscow in particular, when these incidents happen, which at this point is accumulating?
Yeah, these attacks are more, they grab the headlines, but they don't really do any damage. As I say, no casualties, a few smashed windows. Does it affect morale? It depends who you ask. Moscow is a huge city, and these drone strikes really just pinpricks. So I don't think they will affect morale really much at all. I think that the Wagner situation that happened recently certainly affected many people. Many people worry, but a couple of drone strikes, small drone strikes, I don't think really affect morale at all. If they become larger attacks and they start creating casualties, then you might see some difference. But right now, as I say, it's very small attacks. Most people wouldn't even heard the strikes. Very little damage in a huge city. So at the moment, I don't think so.
Thank you very much for that. Johnny Miller there, a correspondent from Moscow. Thanks, Johnny.
Thank you.
Went to Spain. A snap general election there called by Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has resulted in a hung parliament with no party winning an outright majority. With nearly all the votes counted, the Conservative People's Party managed to win 136 seats, far below the tally of 176 to win a majority in the 350-seat parliament. Prime Minister's Socialists came second with 122 seats, and the far-right Vox won 33. Addressing a large crowd in the capital, Madrid, leader of the People's Party, Alberto Núñez Feijóo, said that he would form a government, but a new election is expected if the parties fail to form a coalition. Prime Minister Sanchez announced the snap election in May, after his socialists suffered major setbacks in regional and local elections. The UK House of Lords has approved an anti-asylum bill, sparking massive outrage among civil rights groups. The bill prevents migrants from claiming refugee protection or other human rights, regardless of their situation. Experts say it is grossly inconsistent with the country's obligations under international law.
After securing the required votes in the House of Lords, the migration bill is set to become law in the United Kingdom, enabling the Home Office to detain and remove anyone entering the country to seek asylum. They could also be transported to Rwanda or a third country under the plan. The UK struck an initial £140 million agreement with the East African country last year, but the plan has been stuck in the courts. Former British Prime Minister Theresa May has slammed what critics call the Illegal Migration Bill, or IMB, saying it will consign more people to slavery.
It will enable more slave drivers to operate and make money out of human misery. It will consign more people to slavery.
The United Nations has also lambasted the new legislation and warned that it's against international law.
The bill is at variance with the country's obligations under international human rights and refugee law and will have profound consequences for people in need of international protection.
The UN also raised concerns about other countries following suit. UN refugee and human rights experts believe the IMB will exacerbate the already vulnerable situation of refugees across the UK. The No Accommodation Network, which represents a network of over 140 organisations and charities across the UK, called the passing of the bill shameful.
Whilst not unexpected, the passing of the Illegal Migration Bill marks a profoundly shameful and damaging moment for refugee protection and human rights in the UK.
Just hours after the UK passed the controversial bill, a so-called accommodation barge arrived in Portland Port, Dorset. It's due to house 500 asylum seekers, twice the number of people that it was designed for, raising doubts about its safety. It has drawn strong condemnation from different groups and organisations worldwide, with many describing it as a floating prison. delivering a speech in Westminster, Shadow Home Secretary Yvette Cooper called the new IMB law a con and the use of barges as a sign of the Conservatives' total failure to clear the asylum backlog. A recent poll by YouGov reveals Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's rapidly falling favourability rating, which has sunk to its lowest level to date. In spite of protests and concerns over the anti-refugee plan, the government is adamant that it's the right move. According to official figures, more than 45,000 people were detected arriving by small boats in 2022, 60% higher than in 2021. Now, with the new bill, British authorities have the green light to indiscriminately remove asylum seekers, regardless of whether they are at a risk of persecution, have suffered human rights violations, or are survivors of human trafficking.
Iran and Serbia are set to boost economic ties. According to the heads of parliaments of the two countries, friendship groups have placed cooperation in the fields of industries, energy, tourism, and agriculture high on the agenda. Gisumi Shahmedi has more.
Relations that go back more than 80 years and a second visit of the Speaker of the National Assembly of the Republic of Serbia to Tehran. The two countries are now set to develop bilateral relations and boost cooperation, as announced by Iran's Parliament Speaker.
Parliamentary relations can pave the way for stronger ties between the two countries. This will allow both the public sector and the private sector to make the best use of the opportunities that exist. The parliamentary friendship groups will be following up on that during a joint commission meeting that will be taking place in autumn.
With an eye on Expo 2027 to be held in Serbia, Iran's parliament speaker also said there is great potential for Iran's business sector in the fields of industries, energy, tourism, and agriculture. Comments that were welcomed by his Serbian counterpart, who referred to Iran as an important ally.
The fact that Iran does not recognize Kosovo and supports the territorial integrity of Serbia is very important to us. This means that Iran respects international law.
Serbia is the most important political partner of Iran in the Western Balkans. It is the only country in the region that has not followed the sanctions package of the European Union against the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Iran and Serbia already enjoy close relations, and this visit is expected to boost those ties, particularly as the Serbian delegation will be meeting with Iran's president and the foreign minister. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Iran's president says the permission to desecrate the Holy Quran, which happened recently in Sweden and in Denmark, is an example of, quote, modern ignorance. Ibrahim Raisi said the profane move runs counter to claims of freedom of expression. Meanwhile, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian held a phone conversation with his Kuwaiti counterpart, Sheikh Salem al-Sabah. During the talks, the top Iranian diplomat appreciated Kuwait's condemnation of the sacrilegious acts in Sweden and in Denmark. Amir Abdollahian also called for an emergency foreign ministerial meeting of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation to discuss the desecration of Islamic sanctities. In Pakistan, fresh protests have erupted following the recent desecration of Muslims' holy book, the Quran, in Sweden. The protesters demand the government to end diplomatic ties with the Scandinavian country by expelling the Swedish ambassador from Islamabad. Nasser Kazmi reports.
The people of Pakistan have held countrywide protests to voice their anger at the recent act of desecration of the Quran in Sweden. In less than a month, an Iraqi refugee in Stockholm committed the sacrilegious act twice while protected by Swedish police. The protesters called on the Islamic world to cut ties with Sweden and to expel its ambassadors from their respective countries.
Muslim nations should check out a comprehensive line of action to end such sacrilegious acts. We'll continue our fight for the sanctity of our holy book.
In Europe, where you cannot talk about the Holocaust, burning the Quran is freedom of expression. This is the double standard of Europe. Such hate acts should be stopped.
Meanwhile, religio-political groups in Pakistan also demanded cutting off all diplomatic relations with Sweden, while urging the United Nations to legislate against the desecration of holy books, including the Quran.
Quran was desecrated from the second time in Sweden with the permission of the government. What freedom of expression is this? Global colonialist forces are behind this conspiracy, and the anti-Islam actors of Europe are involved in this insult.
While denouncing the incident, Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif pledged to launch a campaign to end the blasphemy of holy books in the Nordic state. He said that his government would help create a common strategy to eliminate Islamophobia with the help of Organization of Islamic Cooperation.
Muslims around the world have been outraged by the repeated desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden in recent months. They are all in unison that these incidents are blatant provocation, attempting to inflame sentiments and undermine Islam as a religion. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
A new report sheds light on the Israeli regime's arbitrary detention of Palestinians, especially teenagers, in the occupied territories. The Palestinian Center for Prisoners Studies says 570 Palestinian minors were arrested in the first half of this year. The figure shows a 15% increase in the detention of Palestinian children compared to the same period in 2022. According to the report, around 30 of the detainees are under 12 years old. This says Israeli courts have issued around 24 administrative detention orders against Palestinian kids this year so far. The so-called administrative detention is a practice the regime pursues to hold Palestinians behind bars for an indefinite period without any trial or charges. The controversial tactic is coupled with systematic torture of Palestinian inmates. The prisoners are also denied their basic rights. The UK's military ties with Israel have repeatedly come under the spotlight, particularly in the face of the regime's atrocities against Palestinians. The city of Leicester, for example, is the base of UAV tactical systems owned by Israel's largest arms firm, Elbit Systems. Now members of a group called Palestine Action have laid siege to the factory, saying that they will not leave until the production of military equipment for Israel is completely stopped. Pro-Palestinian activist Sarah Wilkinson joined us earlier with more details.
We have been here now for 84 days, and we are going to be here until we shut Elbit down. This is a drone factory, and it supplies the Israeli regime with the drones that are used in Gaza that bomb and maim and terrorize the population, but also now, as we know, in Jenin as well. So it's really important that we lay siege on this place and we stay here until we shut the factory down. From top down in this country, they're doing everything they can to protect Elbit Systems. They're protecting the Israeli arms trade. So we've had several activists arrested, but we're returning to the site when we can. And it's not deterring us from shutting this place down. This is one of the most evil, toxic, deadly Israeli arms factories. And these drones are made on British soil because we supply the plastics and the tin and the aluminium and the steel that they need to make these deadly weapons. So it's essential that we're here. We've shut down two Israeli arm factories already, two Elbits. So this will be our third achievement when this factory is shut.
And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry. Water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence. It breaks with a sad goodbye. Amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby. Thank you.
Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. I cry for you in pain. I cry for you in pain. I cry for you.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
closer.
Iran.
What a steep slope. Fortunately, there is not a long way to reach the Niyabaran Tekiye. You know, I'm going to be there for participating in the mourning ceremony of Imam Hussein, the third infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. In Iran, the mourning ceremonies for Shia Imams are usually held in a place called Tekiye. And the reason I have chosen the Niyavaran Tekiye for visiting is because it is the oldest Tekiye of Tehran, and it's actually a part of the history of Tehran. Please stay with me. Niyavaran Tekiye is the oldest Tekiye in Tehran, which was built during the rule of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar. This Tekiye, which dates back to decades ago, is still a hot spot for mourners during the Islamic month of Muharram, which marks the tragic martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein and his companions. The environment of the Niyavaran Tekiye consists of a rectangular middle courtyard with curved corners, surrounded by arcades in its four angles built in two floors. At the center of this courtyard, there is a circular platform, which is usually used as a stage for performing ta'ziyeh. Initially, the Niyavaran Tekiye used to be an open-air place, and only at the time of mourning ceremonies was covered by a big piece of cloth for the convenience of the mourners. However, the charities of the time raised money for building a roof and gable over the Tekiye. Although this Tekiye has undergone fundamental repairs, its main structure has been preserved. The Niyavaran Tekiye was registered in the National Heritage List in October 2004. Niyavaran Palace on my way, getting toward the north. Oh God, I can't see it. An old structure with a green gable shining like a big emerald gem. And the outer space of the Tekiye is covered with black flags, which represent the mourning atmosphere. You know, it's more than a custom. Actually, it's a culture in Iran that in the month of Muharram, people install black flags at their doors as a sign of grief for the tragic martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. I am now at the entrance of the Tekiye, and there is a huge crowd outside. They are going inside one by one. Well, the main door of the Tekiye is more than 3.5 meters high and is made of almond tree wood. At the door, there is a collection of old ta'ziye stuff, old samovars and teapots, which were used for serving the mourners in the pastime. At this point, you feel like you have traveled to the past.
Mohim Muharram,
Well, now I'm inside the tekkiyeh. Years full of people, men, women, old, young, even children have come to show their respect to Imam Hussein, peace upon him. The ceremony is about to start.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. It's 51 years now since the Palestinian socialist revolutionary Ghassan Kanafani was assassinated by Israel's Secret Service. He was a very effective spokesperson for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. But his eloquence was intolerable to the Zionist entity, which was determined to snuff out the flame of Palestinian rebellion that he represented. Yet his message of hope, ambition and perseverance has meant that his influence has only grown since his cold-blooded murder by Zionist assassins. In a famous 1970 interview, he said, "To liberate our country, to have dignity, to have respect, to have our mere human rights is something as essential as life itself." So in this edition of Palestine Declassified, we look back at his life and legacy, starting with this report by Latifa Abu Chakra.
On July 8, 1972, a light was stolen from the world. The thinker, teacher, writer, and fighter with his pen, Ghassan Kanafani, was killed in a cowardly assassination by the Zionist intelligence agency Mossad in Beirut. The car bomb also took the life of his 17-year-old niece, Lemis. Kanafani was born in Akka, Palestine, in 1936, the third of eight siblings. At the age of 12, he was driven from his home by Zionist racism in the Nakba of 1948. His family went on to settle in Damascus, Syria, which Kanafani wrote about in his short essay, The Land of Sad Oranges. Kanafani studied Arabic literature at the University of Damascus, only to be expelled for his involvement with the Arab nationalist movement of George Habash and Wadi Haddad. Kanafani then moved to Kuwait, where he worked as editor of the Arab nationalist movement's newspaper, Al-Ra'i, The Opinion. Kanafani then moved to Beirut in 1960 and edited another newspaper linked to the organization, Al-Hurriye, Freedom. With the next set of 1967, the Arab nationalist movement of Haddad and Habash became the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP. The organization would haunt Israel across the planet, carrying out some of the most original and daring operations in the history of the Palestinian freedom struggle. Kanafani worked as the PFLP spokesman and editor of their weekly newspaper, Al-Hadaf, The Aim. In his legendary short stories like Return to Haifa and Men in the Sun, Ghassan Kanafani deals with the Palestinian struggle from several different unorthodox angles. Return to Haifa deals with the taboo subject of children left behind in the Nakba and what possible fate could befall them. The complex but moving story also serves to discredit Zionism as an ideology and the biological determinisms of racism. Men in the Sun deals with the overlapping tragedies of refugees searching for sustainable lives in Arab states. The last words of the short story, which depicts Palestinian refugees suffocating to death in the back of a water tank while trying to enter Kuwait for work, haunt the reader. Why didn't they bang on the walls? The words serve as an eternal reminder to our long-suffering people. Bang on the walls. Long live Ghassan Kanafani and long live the resistance.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest today is Omar Zaza. Omar is a writer, poet, independent scholar and organiser, and he's also a member of the Palestinian Youth Movement, as well as the US campaign for the cultural and academic boycott of Israel. Omar is an assistant professor at San Francisco State University, and he joins us today from California via Skype. Welcome to the show. Omar, I wonder if we could start with you. What did Ghassan Kanafani's works mean to you as a Palestinian?
Well, Ghassan Kanafani, in his works, in many ways epitomized, you know, this kind of uncompromising nature of continuing forward in the spirit of liberation until the very end. Not conceding an inch, understanding that, you know, we, the Palestinians, are a people collectively locked in a struggle against settler colonialism and anti-imperialism. And he really gave life to that sentiment through his works. And in many ways, you know, he served to really collectivize the Palestinian experience, sort of taking individual accounts of dispossession, you know, and violence, and turned it really into a sense of kind of a collective condition that all of us can recognize and that we could use to sort of unify ourselves in the midst of this sort of ongoing quest to liberate land and people totally. So in a sense, you know, Kanafani really represented this sort of undying and unwavering commitment, you know, through his writings, through his organizing, to this ultimate goal. And so in many ways, when we celebrate Kanafani's literary achievements, when we celebrate his literary prowess, we're also paying testament to that sort of unwavering commitment to the need to fully liberate land and people from the river to the sea.
Yes. Well, David, I mean, although it's rare, I mean, Israel does have a record, doesn't it, of assassinating non-combatants, doesn't it?
It certainly does. I mean, back as far as 1948, of course, they started with those kinds of assassinations. There was a former Jordanian MP who also edited the PLO newspaper, Kamal Nasser, who was assassinated. And, of course, most recently, we've seen Shireen Abu Akleh, the journalist, killed just last year. So there is a history of this. But, of course, there is also a history of an assassination program by the Mossad through all sorts of various means, including numbers of the people who we're going to talk about today.
Mm. Well, Omar, I wonder whether you could say a word or two about Ghassan Kanafani's position on negotiations with the Israelis.
Well, there's a famous line, you know, from the interview with Richard Carlton where Kanafani is asked, you know, why don't you talk to the Israelis? Talk about what? And is this talk about not fighting? Kanafani responds, talk about not fighting for what? You know, and then on and on and on. And eventually you get the famous phrase, that's the kind of conversation between the sword and the neck. So the idea that, you know, again, that, you know, and sort of unapologetic, unwavering stance that, you know, Palestinians are locked in a total liberation struggle for the complete liberation of land and people. And the idea that sort of conceding to the colonial power through negotiation that does not in any way account for the asymmetry of power that the settler colonialism, you know, of the Israeli state and Zionism impose, is tantamount to suicide and is an abdication of the right, of the need, you know, the imperative to fight for the liberation of land and people.
I mean, David, what can you tell us about the transition of the Arab nationalist movement to the PFLP that was mentioned in Latifa's report there?
Well, the watershed is the invasion of the West Bank, of Gaza and of the Golan Heights by the Zionist regime in 1967. Mm. And the Arab nationalist movement has a shock, a massive wake-up call with that. And it transforms itself into effectively a much more ready-to-fight guerrilla organisation. So the PFLP emerges, it has its armed wing, And that becomes much more of a significant threat to the Israelis. And they engage for many years in many different operations against the Israelis, which really challenge some of the Zionist regime's attempts to suppress the Palestinians and to maintain occupation in the West Bank and Gaza and the other elements of the occupation. So it's a transformation of footing, really, from the Arab nationalist movement to a fully socialist fighting organisation which will directly take on the Israelis. And that's a transformation which we see leading to splits within the Palestinian movement, so that parts of the PFLP, of course, are affiliated to the Palestine Liberation Organization, and other parts are not. So you see the emergence of a much more radical spirit coming through after 1967.
Yeah. I wonder if you maybe just expand a little bit on the structure of the PFLP as well.
Well, the PFLP goes through various iterations, and different factions, and of course there are splits over ideology, but also splits over strategy in terms of armed actions. And of course there's the Associated and the Allied faction of the Black September, which moves beyond the kind of activities of the PLO, things which are accepted to the PLO. So you have the PFLP proper, then you have the PFLP General Command, GC. There's also, of course, the SC faction of the PFLP. So there's a lot of different factions in there, and that's part of the evolving sense of the guerrilla struggle, which the various different factions are engaged in.
Sure. Well, Omar, I mean, how has the legacy of Kanafani and his comrades informed your work with the Palestinian youth movement?
So we see Kanafani, you know, as really very much an enduring and ongoing and vibrant and galvanizing figure and symbol, not just for who he was as an individual, but for everything he represented. And his example, you know, of the concept of adab al-muqawami, or resistance literature, is something that we really took to heart as the Palestinian youth movement. And, you know, we, among other things, we started the Ghassan Kanafani Resistance Arts Scholarship, which is to really cultivate the creativity in Palestinian youth, Palestinian Arab youth, you know, across the world, basically, to really think about the interconnection between cultural resistance and the ongoing liberation, Palestinian liberation struggle. We see really a need to continue to kind of cultivate this collective sense of being a people locked in an ongoing struggle against settler colonialism, against imperialism, and thinking about how culture in and of itself can, you know, help to kind of actualize that goal by making sure that, you know, we never forget that Palestinians continue to remain engaged, continue to reject concessions to Zionist settler colonialism and to imperialism, and continue to create works that will galvanize and stimulate, you know, and awaken subsequent generations. And I think certainly, you know, when we think about kind of a resurgent, kind of a new sort of waves of resistance among ongoing Palestinian generations, we see that there is an unwillingness to forget, an unwilling to compromise, you know, the very things that Kanafani, you know, that and his generation were really pushing for, to ensure that we don't concede, that we don't surrender, that we never forget, that this will be a pursuit of liberation from the river to the sea.
Yeah. Well, David, I wonder whether you could say what precipitated the eventual split between the PFLP and Wadi Haddad.
So you have this process of radicalization from 1967 on, and you have the move towards a much more radical approach from people like Haddad. And he even splits from his longtime comrade, George Habash. And there's a split with the PLO, essentially. And that's one of the things which is really of significant relevance today, is the question about the role of the PLO and, of course, the Palestinian Authority in actually interfering with the liberation struggle, as opposed to fostering the liberation struggle, which was supposed to have been the PLO's role. And this is an early sign of the tensions inside the Palestinian national movement, where the PLO starts to in some senses, compromise, and elements of the PFLP are unwilling to compromise. And, of course, that puts them right outside the space where the Israelis are happy to negotiate, which they have been with the PLO. And, of course, today's security cooperation there is between the Palestinian Authority and Israel is a key weeping sore within the liberation movement. But you have someone like Haddad, who is unwilling to compromise, is associated with Black September, and eventually, of course, what happens is that the Israelis assassinate him. Yeah. I mean, really, really vicious means of assassination. They sneak into his apartment, They changed the toothpaste in his bathroom for a poison so that every day he brushes his teeth, poison seeps into his system. And they don't know what's wrong with him. Eventually, Arafat sanctions him being sent to East Germany to a specialist hospital, and they can't even work out what's wrong with him. And he dies in horrible pain. And this is typical of the Israelis, the kind of strategy they've used to assassinate people who are outside the scope of negotiation according to their strategies.
Yes, indeed. Well, we're just going to pause the discussion there for a moment to report about another Palestinian non-combatant, Neji al-Alali, who was also assassinated, and also about Israel's use of double agents operating in Britain.
Political cartoonist Neji al-Alali was born in 1937 in Al-Sajara village in Palestine, prior to the Zionist occupation. Ali was 10 when the Nakba drove his family out of their village, forcing them to flee to Lebanon, where they lived in the Ain al-Helwa refugee camp in Sidon. He developed his talent for sketching sarcastic interpretations of the political landscape at the time. Ghassan Kanafane met Ali in the camp in the 1950s and helped him get work with a few newspapers. This eventually led to Ali moving to Kuwait to work for the papers Al Siyasa and Al Khabas through the 1960s and 1970s. It was in Kuwait that Ali developed the character he is most famous for, Handala. The depiction of a 10-year-old barefoot and bedraggled Palestinian child with his back turned became iconic across the world. Ali asserted that the character represented the condition of Palestinian refugees waiting to return. Ali's works were not just observational pieces on the Palestinian condition, but also piercing critiques of the major political actors of the day. His attacks on Gulf leaders are believed to be behind his decision to leave Kuwait with his family and settle in London in 1985. Ali had also begun criticizing the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat through his work, particularly the influence of a female companion on the figurehead. Ali was believed to have received more than 100 death threats before his liquidation in London. On July the 22nd, 1987, Ali was shot outside the office of Al Khabas newspaper in Knightsbridge, London. He died around a month later. In the immediate aftermath of the killing, British police arrested Ismail Sowan, who was not only an employee of the PLO, but also an Israeli agent. The Israelis paid the rent for the very apartment that Sowan was arrested in by the British police. Sowan claimed that while he was not the killer, the team that carried out the assassination had used his flat as a base for operations. The British Prime Minister at the time, Margaret Thatcher, was so outraged at this information that she expelled the Israeli handler of Sowan and closed the Mossad base in Britain. The truth of Neji al-Ali's assassination is still unknown, but British police reopened the investigation in 2017.
Omar, I wonder if you could tell us about Neji al-Ali's character, Handala.
Yes, so Handala is a 10-year-old Palestinian refugee child. And in the classic pose, you know, that you see is barefoot and his back is facing the audience and hands clasped behind his back. And many believe that this is a kind of symbolism that denotes a rejection of outside or imposed solution to the Palestinian struggle. And Handala, of course, famously remains 10 years old, right, as Ali had wished for it to be, in part really, you know, symbolizing kind of the ongoing need for the total right of return of the Palestinian people to be implemented and something which has yet to be realized. And so in many cases, people see the perpetual youth of this character as kind of an artistic reflection, you know, of the ongoing need to kind of end this, colonially imposed atrocity and to finally allow the Palestinian people to return home.
David, in Kuwait seems to have been a hope for pro-Palestinian thinkers at different points, doesn't it? I mean, why do you think that was?
Well, I mean, Kuwait was had a policy of allowing Palestinian refugees to come and on preferential terms compared to other immigrants from the region. And so there were very many Palestinians in Kuwait working there, I think a quarter of a million or so, perhaps more. And it was so it was a kind of refuge for Palestinian refugees until, of course, the moment where there was the conflict over Iraq in 1990, when Iraq went into Kuwait. Mm-hmm. It seems that the apparent invitation of the Americans, and the PLO's view was to support Iraq and Saddam Hussein. And thus the Kuwaiti government expelled 250,000 Palestinians. And that was the moment in which that was over, and that game was over. And most of the Arab states, of course, were opposed to Saddam Hussein in 1919, were effectively supporting the West in its military intervention. The Turkey Shoot, if you recall it was called, when they went in and killed thousands of people in the road to Baghdad. And so that was the formation of Kuwait. And of course, you see this process all the way through of the places that the Palestinians had to go to. They went to Jordan, they went to Lebanon, some of them went to Syria, or, of course, in Kuwait. And sometimes those places were closed down. Of course, famously, the Israelis forced the PLO out of Lebanon and sent them over to North Africa in the 1980s. So it's a process of where can these refugees go while they wait to come back to their homes, while they wait to expel the occupiers and to decolonize the occupation of Palestine. So that's the process, and that's why Kuwait was important then, and it became a terror incognito after that, because they couldn't stay.
Well, Omar, I wonder what they might say. I mean, what kind of criticisms did Ali's work level at Yasser Arafat?
So many different types of criticisms, but really the thing to understand about Arafat is, you know, he has kind of a split. On the one hand, you know, seen as a very nationalist figure, very dedicated to the revolution. But what Ali was doing with Arafat, and to a certain extent, as he did with many politicians, was really trying to kind of probe beneath the surface and kind of expose what he felt to be a sense of hypocrisy. So this idea that, you know, there's a total dedication to Palestine, and yet there's an increasing number of decisions that are made that seem to be sort of conceding to the occupier, or, you know, moving toward a negotiated settlement rather than continuing, you know, kind of the armed liberation struggle. And of course, you know, for Ali, this was reflected in certain instances of personal corruption. But ultimately, really, the larger critique is this movement, this seeming concession, you know, that the Palestinian liberation under Arafat was making, moving toward a negotiated settlement rather than continuing, you know, a truly anti-colonial liberation struggle. And of course, this would include Ali's critiques, jibes, including, you know, a cartoon sort of mocking him and mocking his cultural minister, Rashid Mahran. But the political substance of it really is this movement toward concession rather than, you know, and making these decisions that really aren't in the interest of the people.
No, absolutely. I mean, David, I mean, what do you make of these double agents arrested by British police following that killing?
Well, this is a very, very interesting tale. I mean, let's start with the fact that these people were working for Mossad. That whatever else they were working for Mossad. And as you saw in the film there, Margaret Thatcher expels their handler, closes down the Mossad station. And people don't know this, do they? They don't know that actually that the Mossad was engaged in operations against Britain on British soil, that there was a hostile foreign power. And of course, as we've said in this programme before, this is one of many examples where the British security state realises that there's a problem here and it intervenes. And it was Thatcher who shuts down, of all people, the Mossad station. Now, of course, Thatcher has form in relation to Israel. And of course, there was a moment when she was Prime Minister where Menachem Begin came to the UK and she refused to shake hands with him because he regarded him as a terrorist. Now, there's the sign that even Tories can understand and get the point of this kind of spying in the UK. And Margaret Thatcher was up for that engagement. But let's go back to the other question. These were people who were PLO operatives. Were they PLO employees in the civilian sense, or were they armed operatives? And what's unclear about this is not whether the PLO and the Mossad were involved, but exactly what was the apportionment of responsibility. So it's not impossible that the PLO directed these killings, but at the same time, the people who were involved in the killings were actually Mossad double agents. I mean, we don't know exactly what the relationship was, but we already see the kind of dirty dealing and the double dealing of the PLO evident in this case, and that has only become much more significant. So that today we have the PLO engaged through the Palestinian Authority in security cooperation, including arrests and tortures of ordinary Palestinians, including killing ordinary Palestinians. Yeah. And we see that happening as the resistance rises in the West Bank. Now, we have a split, of course, in the Palestinian Authority. There are members of the PLO and Al-Aqsa Brigade, Martyrs Brigades, who are joining with the Lion's Den or with Palestinian Islamic Jihad or with the Al-Qassam Brigades and joining the resistance which is rising in the West Bank. And that's a split. And the more that split continues, the better. But we still see the Palestinian Authority collaborating directly with the Israelis. And that's, you know, truly appalling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I'm afraid that we are out of time today. So let me thank our guest, Omar Zaza, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Until next week, when Palestine Declassified will be back with more investigations and analysis, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Less well-known companions of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. In this two-part series of programs, we aim to introduce the less well-known companions of the Chief of Martyrs, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. Some of the companions of the Imam, peace be upon him, are very well known and much has been written and said about them. However, there are some who are virtually unknown, despite the fact that they fought courageously alongside the Imam and achieved martyrdom and eternal salvation on the day of Ashura, in the desert of Karbala. We hope this informative series will captivate your heart and soul. Stay with us. Certainly, no uprising or movement in the world has ever succeeded without loyal supporters and backers. The Chief of Martyrs Imam Hussein's uprising is no exception. The loyal companions of the Imam played a major role in the uprising. Their loyalty, courage, and self-sacrifice did much to record it in history and turn it into an everlasting epic. Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, himself has been quoted as saying, "I know no group of people more loyal and trustworthy than my own companions." Some of these companions are very well known, and much has been written about them. But others are virtually unknown, and little has been published or said about them. The most outstanding characteristics of Imam Hussein's companions who fought alongside the Imam on the day of Ashura in Karbala can be summarized as follows: patience, purity of intention and honesty, and loyalty and trustworthiness. Those who stood alongside Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, on the day of Ashura in the desert of Karbala, under the harshest and most difficult of conditions, did not fear death and never grew tired, and showed resistance and resilience right until their martyrdom. Truly, the companions of the Imam are exactly what Ayah 12 of Surah Insan in the Holy Quran refers to, where the Lord says, "And their recompense shall be paradise and silken garments, because they were patient." We'll be right back. Muslim ibn Kathir Azdi was one of the loyal and trustworthy companions of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, who had a very effective and meaningful presence in the uprising of Ashura, playing a significant role, but he has been mentioned only rarely in books and writings regarding that momentous event. His father, Kathir ibn Qulayb al-Sadafi, was a learned man and a scholar of the Holy Quran, and a scholar of the Hadith, or the narrations. He was originally from Yemen, and was considered one of the companions of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. During the Battle of Jamal, Muslim ibn Kathir Azdi was 40